attached to it to help it get into orbit, and they're bringing a large satellite to a geosynchronous orbit, right on the equator too. I mean, you know, not 1 or 2 degrees, they're bringing it exactly 0 degrees. It's multiple test experiments that are going to be on this geosynchronous satellite for the Space Force and things like that, Defense Department. But there's one other experiment that they're going to be that's going to be attached to this. It's called the Laser Communications Relay Demonstration. They call it LCRD, you know, so it's a laser communication system, and they're going to use it to test communications, you know, using the lasers, in this case infrared lasers. So once it's in orbit, eventually NASA will test this out. They have two stations, I think, one in California and the other one is in Hawaii, receiving stations and transmitting stations, where they're going to be able to, you know, instead of RF, they're going to use lasers. They've done a couple of experiments like this before, but this is going to be a two-way experiment. They're going to be able to transmit up, transmit down. They've transmitted, you know, down to Earth before, but this is going to be both. They believe they can get up to 100 times more data throughput than what you get with RF. So I'm going to be very interested in seeing how the LCRD works. At the bottom is a massive satellite that will be in geosynchronous orbit. They have this small unit that's attached to the bottom of this satellite. And, you know, they're picking up the power from that satellite. So that should be pretty good. If it's successful, which I believe it will be, they plan on eventually putting a series of these things into geosynchronous orbit, you know, by themselves. They won't need these other big satellites, you know, although they could do that as well. But eventually they plan on having a series of these satellites up there, which will not replace, but probably supplement the existing TDRS system that they have. Right now they have roughly around 11 TDRS satellites, large satellites. You know, I mean, these things are, you know, 7,000-8,000-pound satellites. And TDRS are tracking data relay satellites, NASA's space hub, the Hubble, and, you know, a lot of NASA stuff is always, they're always using TDRS to, they transmit up to it, and TDRS transmits back down to the ground station. So this way, there's never, there's very few dropouts. That's why, you know, you watch an interview on the International Space Station, and they seem to go on, but once in a while, there'll be a dropout. But with the 11, you know, and it'll last for, you know, sometimes 30 seconds. In the early days, of course, you know, they didn't have these TV satellites, and they would drop out for long periods of time, ratty communications. But here, you know, they have video, data, all that, no problem. And that's due to the tracking data relay satellites. So you can imagine if they could have a series of these infrared laser satellites in orbit, if this test goes well, I'm sure they'll be doing that, and they'll be able to transmit data, you know, 10, maybe 100 times more data than you can now, and which they need. You know, there's like 300-400 experiments sometimes going on at the same time on the space station. Some of the experiments aren't even being controlled by the astronauts. You have mission control, you know, operating it. You know, as these people are walking around or sleeping, you know, mission control is poking around with these different satellites that are throughout the International Space Station. You got to remember that place is big. It's probably like a 30-story building right now, from one end to the other. So getting bigger all the time. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Okay, nothing heard. This one company I always follow that seems to be doing very good, and they're always at the cutting edge. It's called Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is run by this guy, Peter Beck. And originally he was born in New Zealand, but he's with the States. You know, he's got his company, Rocket Lab, building rocket engines in California. So it's really an American company, although his first launch facility was in his home country of New Zealand, where he's been launching the Electron rocket, and I think he's probably up to around, I guess, almost 20 flights now. He builds them out of this carbon composite material, light, very, very lightweight, very strong, launches from New Zealand. He built one launch pad there. He's already built the launch pad in Virginia, in Wallops Island, Virginia. So sometime, I'm sure, next year he'll be launching from the States as well. And he also built another launch complex, another one in New Zealand as well. So he'll have three places where he can launch from. His manifest is that busy. So now he's going on to new project. I mean, these Electron rockets are still being built. Right now, everything that's gone up, they haven't reused yet. But the last three that have gone up, they've recovered, with parachutes, and they plan on eventually reusing those boosters. So that will be happening next year as well. I believe it's the next flight. As the booster is coming down on the parachute, he's going to fly a helicopter over with this hook and grab it out of midair and fly it over to a ship at sea and land it on the ship and then have the ship bring it back to New Zealand. So now he's developing a new rocket called the Neutron Rocket. He's got the Electron Rocket. Now he's got the Neutron Rocket. It's also got something called a proton satellite, where he's able to put a lot of small satellites on this proton thing and release them into orbit as it goes around in different locations in space. But the Neutron rocket is going to be also carbon fiber, and it's going to be very wide at the base. I think around 25 feet wide at the base. It's going to go all the way up. It's going to be tapered all the way up, very smooth. Four big legs that they're not going to be movable. It's going to be, it's in one position. And then, again, smooth all the way up to the top. The fairings that are usually most companies, or all companies, just get rid of the fairings and they fly away. SpaceX has been able to recover them and reuse them. Peter Beck's idea at Rocket Lab is to have these things open up, but not disconnect. So the first stage will launch. The first stage actually won't go into orbit, but as it's, in space, it'll be in space. It'll open up the front of the rocket. The fairings will open up. The second stage will leave. Will leave out the front of the rocket, and then when it's far enough away, it will ignite its engine, and then send the second stage off to orbit with its payload. Now this first stage will close the fairings. They'll lock in place. And this whole thing will come back through the atmosphere. very little, if at all, maybe none, TPS system or tile protection system. It'll just, you know, fly through the atmosphere because it's so smooth. It'll go at such a shallow angle that it won't build up that much heat. And plus with the carbon structure, he figures it will survive that kind of a reentry. You know, it's not slowing down from, you know, orbital speed. The orbital speed is like 17,500 miles an hour. This thing will be slowing down from maybe 4,000 miles an hour, which is still, you know, high. But he thinks they'll be able to do it. And he expects the first launch to take place in 2024. He's building his own engines. These will be liquid methane, liquid oxygen engines. He's calling the engines the Archimedes engines. You know, that's going to be the name for these things. And he's going to have seven on the booster and one on the second stage. So I thought I'd bring that up. Probably forget about it for the next year or two until he starts getting to the point where he's able to launch one of these things. It will be human rated as well, so it will not only take payload, cargo, and, you know, someday in the future, he thinks they'll be able to put astronauts on board the Neutron rocket. So, with that, let me see if anybody has any comments, questions. If not, I'm looking at time is starting to get a little late, but we started late. Any comments? This is WS2N.
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu,
go ahead, Ed.
Well, I'm just wondering why they spent $2.5 billion. I know Perseverance does a lot of other stuff, but basically they promoted as being able to drill down a few inches to get sample cores. And are they doing that just hopefully to hit some height? Or why are they spending so much money, you know, on or promoting that function primarily?
Oh, okay. I remember with all the other rovers that we had, Spirit, Opportunity, Curiosity, and also robotic arms, and they would, like, you know, scratch off the rock, and then they would drill into the rock, but it would, you know, it would be powdered, you know, like a regular drill. You would get powdered material that would come off that, you know, out of that hole. They would take the powder and the robotic arm, and they would put it into, they call it, into this chemical factory on board, let's say Curiosity or the two solar operated rovers, Opportunity or Spirit. They would analyze it and you know, figure out what it was made of, that type of thing. To get really good results on different rocks, and you really would like to have those pieces on Earth and have the scientists put it through really super duper machines, maybe a machine that, you know, maybe is as big as Curiosity, that you can't send to Mars, to really get, you know, great information about these particular rocks. So the next best thing to do is to take samples and send them back to Earth. Well, that's what Perseverance is doing. They spent a lot of money on developing this system. At the end of the robotic arm, they have this drill set up, and it's a core boring tool. So when you drill into the rock, you're drilling a core, and then it's removing that core. So now you have a piece, maybe a little bit bigger than the size of a test tube. I think it's around, not quite 3/4 inch in diameter, a little smaller than that, and maybe about 5 inches long. And this whole gadget is designed to take it, put it inside this titanium-type test tube, and then seal it off. I mean, super seal. They figure out that, you know, not a drop of air is going to get into this thing to contaminate anything. 43 of these tubes on board the Curiosity. They plan on using around 30 or 33 to actually put into one cache, they call it, you know, one setup with all the tubes stuck in the, into this one pod, which will be able to, let me drop it. At some point, they'll be able to take these tubes and leave them on the surface of Mars. In the future, probably within a couple of years, NASA plans on sending two more space vehicles to Mars. One is going to be orbiting Mars. It's just going to be there to wait for a return of a spacecraft carrying these samples. The other spacecraft that's launched from Earth that goes to Mars will, you know, not go into orbit, but will actually go down to Jezero Crater, where this thing is, where Perseverance is riding around, land in Jezero Crater. It will know exactly where these tubes are. It's going to have its own small rover. It looks like a four-wheel rover, where all these other rovers are six-wheel. It's going to be able to drive over, pick up all these tubes, and put them in its cache unit, and bring it back to the lander where it had just landed. Northrop Grumman, as we speak, is building this solid booster rocket that will be attached to this lander. This new rover that picks up all these samples, say 30 some odd samples, will take all these tubes and place it inside the nose cone of the solid engine rocket. Thing will tip forward, skyward, point skyward, and ignite and take off. It will then dock with, rendezvous and dock with this other spacecraft that NASA had already just sent up there. Because that's going to have a whole lot of fuel on it, because that's going to deorbit Mars, and it's going to head directly to Earth. So it'll eventually come back to Earth. It will have a descent module on board that will accept all these tubes that are sitting in there, where the other rover has put it. It'll take all these tubes and put it into this descent vehicle with a heat shield and parachute. They'll deorbit that, and they plan on landing it in the Utah desert. So without this thing working, and there were some problems in the beginning, they were worried about it. They drilled a hole, and they took the sample out, and they thought the sample was inside the titanium tube. And they saw nothing. Where to go, if you were up there, you'd be looking around. Is it under the wheel? What happened to this thing? So anyway, they figured out what went wrong, and they eventually drilled another hole, and that was successful. And I guess over the next couple of years, they'll be drilling, holes in different rocks. That's what I know about that. Ed, back to you.
All right. I didn't think they were drilling into rocks. I thought they were drilling beneath the surface of Mars. And that was the whole thing. I didn't think they were drilling into rocks on the surface of Mars. But, boy, if they pull this one off. And by the way, it was that drilling mechanism and bringing the dirt back up into those tubes, those cylinders, that caused the overheating of the friction. Because they were too clean, they were too decontaminated. That was the problem that they had to solve, which they originally did by some simple method. But, all right, thanks a lot, Paul. Appreciate it. WPTZ, I guess back to net.
Okay, thanks for the input and the information. And it sounds like a great documentary. I wish these things would make it to public TV. You know, there's so many different streaming things that you can get now. You know, they put it on one, you know, five other people with different streaming setups are going to miss it, you know. Put it on Netflix, or even that you have to sign up for that. Put it on Channel 2. I think that would be great. Broadcast TV. I don't know. Anyway, thanks for everybody listening to the space portion of the net, to the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And tomorrow is the Club InfoNet. That'll be on these repeaters as well. Followed by George, KD2FRU. We'll do the Swap and Shop, and then after that you have Newsline. I always like listening to Newsline. I know you can get it online, but it's more fun to listen on radio. Anyway, we'll turn it over to you, Roy, AC2GS. This is WS2N. Back to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for your help with the TechNet. Thank you for all that you do for this club. Just want to thank everyone out there who participated. I had lots of fun. I hope you did too. I hope not too many people threw their radio against the wall. There's this little thing called an off switch if you don't like what you hear. And there's even a frequency. There's a VFO dial. You can find all kinds of interesting other conversations. So keep that in mind. But again, want to thank everyone who participated tonight. You guys make or break a technical net with your interactions, and I hope we all learn something, and I hope we all come back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. to do it all over again. As always, want to remind you that if you want to contact me, you can do it through the email. The address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to contact Paul, his is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, my link page is available 24/7. Just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the link page. If you want to listen to the audio stream of the repeater, that should be available most times. Just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And always keep in mind my KC2NJI's wonderful archive site. It has Limark technical nets going as far back as September of 2006. A lot of great wisdom from many hams that have unfortunately become silent keys over the years. But their voice and their wisdom is still alive in recorded form. Again, that's amateurradio.tv. As always, I like to leave the technical net in a similar line that Dick K2RIW used to use for 38-odd years here. Be kind to each other. This is always good advice. It was always good advice when Dick said it. It's now particularly good advice. Take care. Be safe. Be good to yourself. Be good to each other. Be good to your loved ones. Even be good to the people you hate, because we're all in this together. So, and for those that are still celebrating Chinooka, have a happy last day of Chinooka. So thanks to everyone. Be well. Soon Christmas and New Year will be upon us. I hope you'll join me for the weekly TechNets. This is AC2GS, and I am formally closing this second Hanukkah edition of this year's Limark TechNet, and I am clear.
Is it possible to be a late check-in?
Certainly. We don't really use check-ins. Dick used to say that he already knew people were listening to him. He just wanted people to list their call signs if they had a question or a topic. But if you would like to check in, feel free.
This is N2LDY. First Personal is Dawn. I'm in Center Reach, and I just want to thank everyone for all the good information that was given out tonight. Thank you very much, and I'll be clear.
Okay, very good, Don. Please come back and consider participating. It's lots of fun.
Okay, 7-3.
N2. N2LBY, N2HUH.
N2HUH, N2LBY.
How you doing? It's been a long time. Long time no hear. Long time no speak.
True, I have my active times and my inactive times, but I have the radios set up now again in my room here. I have the HS set up, and so I leave the radio on in the background most of the time.
Alrighty-o. I'll assume that you remember me from way back then. Handy Andy, N2HUH, into astronomy. I know you used to, you would get into a lot of different things. You still making those great drawings, like you used to?
What you said, I'm sorry, what was it? And I still have the telescope here. I was just setting it up again. My daughter moved from California out to Lake Grove here, so she's only a couple of miles from where I am. So I was redoing the telescope. I figured I'd get my grandchildren out there one evening and let them take a look. So what was the other question?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember I had got an eyepiece or two from you. I know you used to find some of the local sales around the neighborhoods. I was curious if you uncovered anything interesting in the past couple of years. You'll have to refresh my memory. What telescope model do you have?
I have two. I have a Celestron, and I think it's 10-inch. And then I have a Mead. Oh, I'm not sure. You know, Cassegrainian. No, well, the Celestron is a Cassegrainian. And the Mead is just a simple, I think it's only 90 millimeter. I had picked up at a yard sale one time for like 20 bucks, you know. And, you know, it has the controller on it and stuff. But, yeah, and then I still have my collection of different lenses and optics for it.
Okay, so the Mead is probably an ETX-90. And the Celestron, depending on what color the tube is, it could be plain orange, it could be metal flake orange, it could be black or gray. It sounds like you may have a SCT, Smith Cassegrain. Do you have the fork mount with that, like the CPC 11 or 10? Or do you have a German equatorial mount with the Celestron?
No clue. The body of the telescope is just plain orange.
Ah, an oldie but a goodie. Does that have a, that's probably, you probably don't have the electronic go-to, but you might have the electronic locator that if you move it if you move it with your hand, it'll tell you when you're on target.
There's no electronics on it, you know, but it's a good telescope, though.
Yeah, you have the SCT-10 then. That may have been a model that came with an option at one time. If you have the correct mount, and there was a device that you can punch in the object you want to look at, and you have to move it by hand. There's no motors involved, but you would move it, and the display would tell you when you're actually on that target.
Oh, but that sounds interesting. And let's see, what else? I don't know. I mean, I've gotten into, 3D printing over the past couple of years here.
okay. What was the most usable item that you 3D printed?
Usable item? That's a good question. I mean, I do SolidWorks, you know, so I can, you know, if I need a part, I can actually design it in SolidWorks and then print it. Oh, actually, here, like right in front of me, I bought one of these, you know, like cheap, you know, 100-watt antenna tuners, you know, the automatic antenna tuners, and you get the board like for $30 or something. So I actually designed a case for it, you know, and mounted the whole thing in there, and then I took some copper tape, and I lined the whole inside with the copper tape, you know, to shield it, and the thing works great. So yeah, I'm always finding uses for it. Right now, in the background, as it's running, let me just unkey a second. I'm actually printing some Christmas ornaments for the family.
Oh, okay. Christmas ornaments. Now, let's see. It might be difficult, but I'm thinking of almost like either caricatures, or taking a photograph and seeing if there's a program that can actually take a photograph of someone and then kind of make a 3D print a picture on a ornament and that sort of thing.
You know what? You could have been more on target than you actually were. That is exactly what I'm doing right now. I'm printing what they call a lithopane.
Well, better that you said that than me. I'm very intuitive, but sometimes I can't be sure if it's... I really don't, I don't think I believe in ESP, but a sort of, maybe there's a, if you have a connection with somebody, you can actually come up with these things, like, I don't know. I don't know if it's just my logic sometimes, like, I'll have the phone in my hand, and like 2 seconds later, my YL will call me, or that sort of thing. It happens quite often. More often than not, actually. She says, I think she only has to let it ring a half a ring to one ring, and I'm answering the phone, so. It's either that or I always have the phone in my hand, which I don't. But anyway, that aside, pretty good. Yeah, that's exactly what I would do. I think that's a nice personal touch. Very good.
Funny that you were 100% on target with that one. I couldn't believe it when you were saying it. And I'm saying, he's talking about exactly what I'm doing here, you know. and as per the ESP or whatever, or the sixth sense, it happens all the time between me and my son and my daughter and myself. Like, My daughter, okay? So I'll buy her something for her birthday or for Christmas, right? It'll be wrapped in a box. I did not tell anybody what I bought for her. And she'll come, and I say she has like an 80% track record of knowing exactly what I bought for her without any clue, without having any clue, you know? So I don't know how it works, but it works.
Yeah, again, I'm not sure if it's coincidence, if it's just logic, or if there is something cosmic going on there. Okay, let's see. Back to my, I always had this idea again of, I'm not sure how often I would use it, but making a, if you play chess, a chess set of people in the family might be interesting, especially if you make one of somebody you don't like, you know, like the sister or the aunt or somebody flying out of a room or something like that. chest that you make that tonight, I guess. But if I ever get my hands on a 3D printer, that's one thing I would probably want to design is a themed chest set. Although I'm just not sure I would enjoy playing with it, but I'm sure I would get a lot of laughs out of it. Whether I finish the game or not, I think I would just laugh at it a lot. So it may be worth it just for the smile or the and other people involved, the smiles or the scorns.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I did print a chest set with about a year or so ago. I printed a small chest set with the printer. I kind of like the look of the pieces, you know. And that was actually when I was first experimenting with the one I have right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many themes depending on what you're into, whether it's family members or your favorite musical artists or whatever, etc. Political figures or otherwise. All right. Do you still hang out in the hot tub in the winter?
I do. I was actually out there last night. I'm probably going to go out there again maybe in an hour. But yeah, I still have it. I still hang out in there. It's a nice place to relax, you know. Yeah, I used to sit in the hot tub and I had the HT, and I used to do the cross band repeat, you know, through the radio in the room here.
Yeah, I remember that, and I think you also had a good, sometimes you also had a decent view of the night sky. Very relaxing. I could picture myself in a hot tub with either a parallelogram mount with binoculars on it or something like that at the same time, if it's open sky. I know I've done the amateur radio and the night sky observing at the same time.
So when I was getting home tonight, I saw, I'm sure it was Jupiter up in the early night sky, and I think Saturn is up there too still. I had a lot of things on my plate, so I couldn't go out and set it up and take a quick look at it.
Yes, that was probably Jupiter. I think Saturn was the last time I looked that I saw it. I think it was about 15 degrees ahead of Jupiter. So that would be to the right. It's not very bright. It's actually quite dim compared to Jupiter.
No, we went out, I think it was like a week and a half ago I went out, and I brought my brother-in-law out with me. He's staying with us right now, and I showed him the International Space Station going over. You know, I looked on the app, and I said, oh, it's at a good spot, you know, because it was at 70 degrees, you know, and so I said, well, let's go out. I want to show you something, you know. And sure enough, you know, there it came over, you know, I showed him what it looked like. He was interested.
Yeah, I've done that quite a few times, and it's hard to track with a handheld optic. I've tried that a couple of times also. I mean, I could be exaggerating. I thought during a daylight pass, but you know, getting close to dark, but daylight. I could almost swear I saw solar panels, but I cannot not be sure. And I didn't even look that up on a computer to see if that's possible or not. Although I was always seeing iridium flares without even looking for them, just by looking up and just doing whatever I'm doing, I was catching a lot of iridium flares by accident. That was good too. But yeah, the space, the ISS passing by, and still haven't been able to hit the repeater that they have on board.
Hey, you know what just popped into my mind too? On 4th of July this year, I was at my daughter's house in the afternoon, and you want to know what I saw? I saw a UFO. I'm telling you, I saw a UFO. I have a small movie of it on my telephone. We're sitting there in the back, and, you know, hanging out, and I'm looking up, and I see this, like, really bright white, you know, round little dot there, and I'm watching it, and it's, like, not moving. It's in the same spot, you know, and I'm watching, and I'm watching, and I'm watching, and I point it out to my daughter. So then I go, and I run back to my car, and I got my telephone, and I came back, and I started taking, you know, a video of it, you know. So I took, like, a, I don't know, maybe a minute's worth of video, and then I stopped, and it was still there for another couple.
You sort of cut out at the end.
And after I, you know, finished taking a little movie of it with my iPhone, it was still there for another couple of minutes, and it was in the exact same spot. And then it was just gone.
So the most odd characteristic or unexplainable characteristic would be that it was there and then it was gone, but you didn't actually see it moving and gone or moving at a high rate of speed. It was just there, and then you blinked your eye and it was gone.
Pretty much, you know, I could have turned away for a minute or, you know, a few seconds and whatever, but it was there and then it wasn't. So who knows? I don't know. But it was pretty freaky.
Is there anything about it that you would say that you would think that it wasn't a drone or something along those lines, or sort of like a balloon that for some reason wasn't floating around because there was no wind or something along those no drafts or otherwise?
I don't think so, but I mean, if there's a way I could shoot you, you know, I could email you the video I took of it. If we had a way to do that, I would do that for you.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm at my call sign N2HOH at hotmail.com.
Let me find a pen. I'll just jot it down so I don't forget.
Of course, from my experience, I always hated daytime UFOs because there's no perspective of anything. You know, if there is, that makes it a little bit more interesting when there's another object that you can compare it to. Whether it's a plane passing by or otherwise, but nighttime is a little different because there's always something, if it's a clear night, that you can compare it to. But, yeah, I've actually saw a couple of strange things in my, going back quite a few years ago also.
What was I going to say? Well, I got the tree. I mean, the tree in the yard is in the shot, so you can, like, kind of judge it, you know, from looking at the tree. So it does have a reference point, to you know, so to say.
Okay. I'll be happy to take a look at it. And Yeah, my observation was more strange. It was three red lights in the sky, and that's way many years ago before anything consumer would match this, but a consumer product. But three red lights in the sky, like a triangular configuration, and then they actually did move in different directions. One after the other, and not at the same time. That was one of the stranger things I ever saw in the night sky.
I'll try and get this out to you tomorrow. And if I'm gonna be around or whatever, I'll let you know when I'm going to be around, unless you want to get in there and comment on it or whatever.
All right, you're very good. So during the past couple of years, I know people were throwing things out left and right from getting wet or damaged or otherwise for those storms we were having. So part of my question before was, did you ever find anything interesting in those situations?
Nothing's coming to mind right now. What other projects have I done recently? Well, at my last job, I was machinist there for like 6 or 7 years, and I built a whole bunch of projects there. You know, one of them was I built a bunch of different laser engravers.
Oh, laser engravers. Okay. So you still keep them busy. Got me thinking. Yeah, if I had more room, I think I would have a 3D printer myself, but I just don't have no place to put anything anymore. I finally ran out of room. Too many hobbies.
N2LDY, I heard the ID go by. Well, actually, my favorite little 3D printer is called a King Rune. And it has a very small footprint. It's like a foot by a little over a foot, and then it's only like, I don't know, 18 inches tall or something like that. And the power supply is separate from it, but you can put the power supply any way you really want it, you know? So it takes up very little room on the desktop or the table or wherever you put it.
Okay, that's cool. I've seen a couple in person. All right, I gotta get ready to take care of a couple of things and get ready to retire for the night. But I'll see you again there, Don. Good talking to you, good hearing you. Stay well. Take it light from Handy Andy, N2HOH.
Talking to you. Yeah, actually, I just actually retired, sort of. Well, I was forced to retire back in January because of the pandemic. I had my hip put in last November. Then when I went back to work in January, they didn't want to take me back because business was too slow. So I collected unemployment, and then I just started collecting Social Security. But I actually have a part-time job, so I'm still working part-time. All right, 7:30, have a great night, and we'll catch up soon, I'm sure.